For more information about Ancient Dragon Zen Gate and Tygen's teaching, please visit us at ancientdragon.org.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome. I'm very happy to have giving a talk tonight Roy Wyman, who's our Ancient Dragon Zen Gate work leader and member of our board. So, Roy, thank you very much.
Thank you. I told Tygen the best I could get to a sort of catchy title for this talk is Theories of Emptiness and Emptiness of Theories. I want to talk a little bit about the stories that we tell ourselves and how we think of the world and the metaphors we use when we think about the world and reality around us. Some of you may know I work for a big company, and there's a tendency in companies to come up with really sort of strange ways of using language. In fact, I think that every business school, there's some sort of torture chamber where they keep the English language and they just prod it and poke it and have horrible things come out of it. So I thought that I would translate the title of this into corporate. So this is how it would sound in corporate. I'm going to level set in order to socialize learnings and shift paradigms to better leverage the Dharma. If any of you have been in a corporate setting, you understand that I've actually heard all of those expressions used in that way, except Dharma. It's the only word I haven't heard used. And I think that Google Translate really needs to come up with a English to corporate translator. So I think, you know, we should monetize that stat. So you'll notice one of the terms that was used in there, and incorrectly, like every other term that was in there, was paradigm and shifting paradigms. And that was actually one of the things going on in my mind is when coming up with this talk was the way that people talk about paradigms and the way that they completely use and misuse and abuse that term in every way possible. So I want to start with a little bit of a book report. And I give you warning at the start, I haven't actually read this book in about 20 years. But it's a great one, and it still sticks with me, which is Thomas Kuhn's The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, which is what actually came up with, he coined the term paradigms and paradigm shifts. And prior to Kuhn, the belief was that science progressed through slowly accumulating new facts, which led to new theories, and it was just this sort of steady progress, step after step, to build up to a closer understanding of truth and reality. What Kuhn realized was that scientific progress doesn't work that way. But actually what happens is scientists find things that just are what they call anomalies. Stuff that just doesn't work the way that the theory says it should. And when that happens, they have to find a new way of looking at the world. And it's not just by slowly changing it or finding some new way, or as they would use it at work, finding some new way to make more money is not a paradigm shift. A paradigm shift is when you basically throw out the way that we're thinking of everything in that field and come up with a new way of doing it. Let me give you a quick example. Aristotle believed that things fell or rose based on their inherent nature. So a bowling ball is heavy because its natural place was in the center of the universe, which was, of course, underneath our feet. So a bowling ball wasn't really falling, it was just moving to its natural place in the middle of the universe. Likewise, something light, like fire, its natural place was, of course, within the inner sphere of the moon, where all light things go to rest. And so they just naturally went up. And people believed this for thousands of years. And there was actually a term for that, that something moved according to its inner gravitas. Galileo found something that we would call an anomaly. And that is that stuff that was heavy and light fell at the same rate. Sometimes it doesn't seem that way because of how the air catches it. But they actually did an experiment on the moon. Somebody dropped a feather, and what was it, a rock? and they both fell at the same rate. So Aristotle's way of looking at objects as having an inherent nature was wrong. And Newton gets credit for this. Hooke also, you know, there's a fight. I don't want to have a food fight here, fighting over Hooke versus Newton. I know you guys are going to fight about that later on at tea. But he found that gravity is the force that is exerted on objects. And if you take away the large object next to the object, i.e. the Earth, gravity isn't there, and so objects don't act the same. In other words, if you have a bowling ball in space, it's not going to fall towards the Earth. It's not going to fall towards anything. Problem. More anomalies were found. The orbit of Mercury didn't do exactly what it should have done under Newtonian physics. So there were lots of efforts to kind of tinker with it, fix it, get it to work. And Einstein figured out, oh, I know what the problem is. The entire theory. And he said, no, gravity isn't the way to think of it. It's bending of space and time itself. And so he found a new way of looking at it, that a tiny anomaly of millimeters every, what is it, like 10 years or so in Mercury's orbit was enough to throw out the whole theory. Here's the thing, though. You and I, no matter how much education we have, no matter how much we may have studied physics, we still think like Aristotelians. We still think of things as falling because they're heavy. We evolved that way. Because every creature up until, you know, not that long ago, less than a century, just assumed everything had its inherent weight because we all lived on the Earth. And as far as I know, no one's ever been born in space. We've all still been born with gravity. And Aristotle's theory works. So no matter how much physics we may study, when somebody throws us a ball, nobody's going to pull out their slide rule and figure out Newton's calculus or the shape of space-time continuum to figure out how to catch that ball. They're just going to assume, oh, it's heavy or it's light. They're going to, you know, get the trajectory. We think like Aristotle did. Because evolution works by rules of thumb. And if the rules of thumb work, there's no reason for us to learn otherwise. Now, if 1,000 years from now we have generation after generation born in space and weightless, maybe they'll come to think in a more Newtonian way or in a more Einsteinian way under the general theory. But, you know, for now, this is how we think. So what the heck does this have to do with Buddhism? Good question I ask myself. Let me start with this. When people start sitting, they think that to sit half lotus or full lotus, you have to have noodles for legs. That's how you do it, is you just have flexible legs, and that's what makes you able to sit like this. No. It has nothing to do with your legs. It's your hips. If your hips are flexible, then your knees can get on the cushion and on the zabuton. And the advantage of that is that it makes you more stable. That's why, you know, if your knees aren't touching, you know, you're just putting a pad under that or something to give you that stability. Likewise, if your mind is rigid, you will lack the stability required. Flexibility of mind, just like flexibility of hips, allows your thinking and your worldview to be more stable. It is not a rigid way of thinking. It's not a rigid mind that leads to stability. You know, we think of people who are fixed and dogged and sure of themselves as being stable, but they aren't. They're ready to fall over at anything. The more flexible one's mind is, the more that our thoughts and ultimately our words and actions can be flexible, can be appropriate to any circumstance. Second lesson from all of this is don't be sure of anything. Don't lock into something just because it's obvious. Aristotle's view is obvious. Newton's view now to us sounds obvious. obvious and horribly, completely wrong. Seeing reality is to see our own limitations. 3rd concept. One of the precepts is that a disciple of the Buddha abstains from clinging to anything, even the Dharma. This is a radical departure from how most religions think. I mean, the whole point of religions is to give you something to believe in, hang on to, and to know is true. How else can we keep everybody in agreement if we can't even agree on our own belief systems? The precept is completely radical. I'm not aware of anything quite like it in the religions that I've been exposed to. This precept, however, is really obvious, unavoidable, when you're faced with the truth of emptiness. That the theories that we believe in, that the way we look at the world, of our Aristotelian, and I'm probably saying that wrong, but physics, is wrong. Then we see that only in emptiness can we be freed from clinging. But if we really accept the emptiness of thought, then it's natural to not cling, even to our own beliefs. Einstein has a quote that's quoted all the time, which is, I think, really good and apropos here, which is, reality, he said, is merely an illusion, albeit a very persistent one. One of our illusions is that there is a correct way of seeing the world. Just like thinking something is heavy or light, we think that a thing is true or false in and of themselves. We think that bowling ball has weight in and of itself. We think that nature has truth in and of itself. The bowling ball only has weight in the context of being within the Earth's gravity. And things are true or false only in their contexts. Our correct way of looking at the world isn't going to be correct in a different context. So, here's an interesting question. At least I find it interesting, otherwise I wouldn't be asking it, I suppose. Is Einstein's theory correct? If not, what's going to follow it? String theory? Some other theory? When are we going to get to that correct thing? And I believe that at root, none of them are. That they're all metaphors. They're all stories. They're all ways of us trying to find yet another rule of thumb to make reality fit into something we can get our arms around, into something neat and tidy. And that's what science does, and it's very good at it. We wouldn't have technology, we wouldn't have a lot of things if it weren't for that. But ultimately, I don't think they get us to ultimate reality. Ultimate wisdom, I think, experiences things directly without those metaphors, without those stories, without those theories. The Buddha said, in what is seen, there should be just the seen. In what is heard, there should be just the heard. In what is sensed, there should be just the sensed. In what is thought, there should be just the thought. So the Buddha takes us from this sort of ontological, this reality-based emptiness, and he takes that the next step, which is to say that having one mind consistent with ontological emptiness is the nature of facing reality. And that's where we have this distinction that we sometimes make between discriminating mind and non-discriminating mind. That is, the discriminating mind is that wonderful, scientific, useful way of looking at the world that says this is not that and that is not this. And coming up with these metaphors and theories and stories. Left to itself, though, discriminating mind can lead to fixity in the mind. We get stuck. We think that our thoughts and our theories are permanent and fixed and relate to reality as it is. The problem is our brains are just too small. As a species, we'll just never get there. So the non-discriminating mind allows us to step back from that discriminating mind and say, not that either. It allows us to be open to different paradigms, to new ways of thinking about it. And even when we come up with a new paradigm that we think is just wonderful, we don't fall in love with it. And we don't fall in love with our own brains, hopefully. So why do we need discriminating mind? Well, for one, have you ever tried to drive down the street with non-discriminating mind? It doesn't work really well. In addition, non-discriminating mind, when it's left to itself, can be corrupted with superstition, with blind faith, with ego, with all kinds of issues. And so I think that if we just live in a world where there's nothing but non-discriminating mind, we aren't ever tempered with the reality that, you know, what this is, that, you know, living in the real, you know, in the day-to-day world. And that can pull us back from sort of a blind faith or superstition that's just divorced of anybody else ever really getting in our way. It's only by rubbing up against bad situations, other people, dealing with issues, dealing with people who use terms like monetize and level set, you know, through having those frustrations of life, it keeps us grounded in a different way. I've got another question that I found fascinating. I hope you do too. So, is Einstein more right than Aristotle? I mean, obviously we think so. Einstein has fewer anomalies that we're aware of. But I'll tell you, it's an unfair question. As I already said, that to my mind, all of these are just metaphors and stories. And so we cannot say, okay, this is absolute truth, and then say, okay, here's Einstein real close to it, and here's Newton, and here's Aristotle further away. Because to rank them that way, you're assuming that there's some final state that we're going to get to, and that reality in itself cares what we think is the ultimate truth. If we let go of this, then what we can see is that each theory has its place. You know? If Caitlin throws me a football, I'm going to use Aristotle to catch it. If I need to figure out calculus, I'm going to use Newton. And a lot of times, for most physicists, most of the time, they use Newton. They don't use Einstein, because Einstein takes too long, the math's too hard. There's a time and a place for everything. And we have to see our theories as developing at different times. A razor to cut my beard is appropriate for me. It's not appropriate for a toddler. There's a time for toys, and there's a time for tools. There's a time for each theory, and there's a place for each one. So, let's talk a little bit then about how all of this can relate to the real world and the world we're looking at right now. And one of the things that has really caught me, my mind and made me interested in this is the LGBT issues that we're facing. And a loved one came to me a few years ago and said that she was queer. And I said, isn't that the wrong term? I thought that was, you know, something you don't say. Well, it's become much more common now, and everybody seems to be much more aware, more people are aware of queer theory, which I see as an example of a paradigm shift, and a very interesting one. So we have, in this culture, a sort of traditional way of looking at marriage, of relationships, of gender, of sexuality. And that says you have a man, you have a woman, they get married, they have children, birds and bees. We all know this story. What the marriage equality movement has done is they have used that paradigm, as I understand it. Now, I could be getting this totally wrong, and feel free to correct me. But as I understand it, what they're saying is there's this right that men and women have to marry the opposite sex. What's so special about them? Two women should have the same right. Two men should have the same right. And it assumes and takes for granted the same concepts of relationships and rights. What queer theory does, as I understand it, is that it doesn't argue based on the same concepts. It doesn't talk about rights. It doesn't talk about gender relationships. It doesn't talk about marriage in the same way. What it says is that people are not fungible. They aren't widgets. They don't come off an assembly line in two varieties, John Wayne's and Barbie's. And that God ordained that John Wayne's and Barbie's marry each other. Or that God thinks it's fine for John Wayne's to marry John Wayne's and Barbie's to marry Barbie's. What queer theory says is that sex is not fungible in that way. Gender is not fungible. And saying that people have this inherent nature is like Aristotle saying that a bowling ball has an inherent weight. We have a gender and a sexuality based on a context. And in this context, we have folks who are generally considered sort of traditional and those who are on the outside. And the LGBT community has been on the outside. But what queer theory has said is that you don't have to be gay or lesbian or transgender to be on the outside. You can be a man and a woman married to each other, and because of your way of viewing gender or who you want to marry or how you want to live, be seen as on the outside. And so it can incorporate polyamory. It can incorporate a man and a woman where the woman takes the dominant role and the man takes the less dominant role. It can, you know, incorporate a couple that decides to switch off every other week. There's lots of things. People are not fixed and fungible. We're all unique. But do you see how this is a paradigm shift? It throws out the idea of gender as a fixed thing. It throws out the idea of rights as being the same. It throws out the idea that traditional marriage is the only way of looking at the world. It sees gender and sexuality as much more fluid. And it is consistent with a concept of the emptiness of objects. That we aren't born necessarily with either as a John Wayne or a Barbie. That we aren't fixed in that way. And, you know, I was thinking about this. The sexuality of two 18-year-olds. I don't care if they're gay or lesbian, whatever, transgendered, is much more similar than me at 50 and an 18-year-old. I'm much different, more different than I was when I was 18 in my sexuality than I was to somebody who's gay at 18. Because sexuality changes. It evolves over time. I see sexuality and gender much differently than I did back then. And I really wish that, I don't know, maybe we did, but I don't know if Buddhists had anything to do in the evolution of this concept. I'd like to think that this sort of fluid way of looking at the world, of throwing out these sort of theories and starting from scratch with an idea that we are all born into a context and that the context defines us as much as we define the context. I'd love to think that we were involved with that. And that's the sort of paradigm shifts that I think I would love for us all to be more involved with. I think there's a few other areas where we could really see these sorts of paradigm shifts, and I'd love to see them, and where there's a lot of work being done by Buddhists. Joanna Macy is a great one, and I think her views on economics really throw out the typical way of looking at economics, which says that you have to have ever-expanding markets, ever new areas to develop, and it says that we have to live within, you know, sustainable markets, which is not how it's typically thought of. The environment and a lot of the work that Tigan is doing and looking at this, that we have this paradigm that nature is something that we husband. That, and yeah, that's a paternalistic expression and it's appropriate. And we have this sort of way of looking at the world like, you know, we humans are the husband of this and we're going to, you know, dominate it in some sort of medieval sense. I think Tigan and others are pointing to a new model that says humanity is part of nature and not apart from it. And I would go so far as to see what we have done to our nature around us as a type of cancer. Mm-hmm. And that we humans are a cancer that we need to address. And this is a new metaphor. I think in the law, you know, we could look at a new paradigm where you do not have, you know, Doe v. Doe. You do not have a V in the middle and two parties seen as separate. I think we need to open up the concepts of law so that we have others as part of that group, where you have the future generations part of it. And I think that's something that Joanna Macy would suggest. The Earth could be a party to it. I think we need to have it much broader. So I think I'm running low on time.
Yes.
And so I will leave it at that, just to say that there's a lot of areas where we can develop this, and I hope that you will go back to your world. Your work, your life, your home life, and with a more open and flexible way of viewing the world, and be open to new ways of looking.
Thank you very much, Roy. Just to say, you know, I want to open this up for general response, just to say that what you're talking about is very deeply Buddhist way of looking at things, that, and you mentioned the precept to not hold on to particular views, and to see to see change. Change is an essential part of Buddhist worldview, and that you were pointing to paradigms or, you know, worldviews changing, and this has implications, deep implications for practice, that to practice adapting our views and to be flexible about how we see our relationships to each other and to the earth, and to also be open to working with all those views. I was thinking of Blake's statement that anything that can be imagined is an image of the truth. So all the views, all the paradigms have something to teach us. Anyway, you brought up a lot of practical areas for this, so I'll just open this up to comments and responses to Roy. But thank you very much. Bill.
One thing I take from Thomas Kuhn is that things really progress through discontinuity rather than continuity, and that there are periods where continuity makes sense, but there come points, as you say, when the anomalies accumulate, when a breakthrough is needed. And I wondered if you thought that applies to the Dharma itself, so that there could be successive stages of Buddhism that would probably seem very foreign to the earlier Buddhas. For me, the most radical perspective on this sort of thing is already given in the Heart Sutra. And I think it's interesting, there's a recent commentary on the Heart Sutra by the German Buddhist, his name's Karl Bielfeld, is that his name?
He's an American. He teaches at Stanford, yes.
Oh, right. And his commentary is called the Heart Attack Sutra, because purportedly when the Buddha preached this sermon, even his closest followers were so freaked out by it that some of them fell down dead from heart attacks. Seems to me that's a pretty serious teaching of discontinuity. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I'd like to know what you think about the Dharma of discontinuity.
I'd have a couple thoughts on that. I think that's an excellent point. One thing that comes to mind is obviously there has been radical change and very rapid change in Buddhism in this country just since the 60s. I think you could compare our Buddhist practice here tonight to what was practiced in Japan, still practiced in Japan, and say that the Dharma here has evolved more in, you know, what, 50 years, 60 years, than it has maybe in centuries in Japan and China. Because as, and that's not unique to the United States. It evolved radically when it moved from India to China, and when it moved from China to Japan and into Korea and into different cultures, into Tibet. And that's why there's so many different practices within Buddhism. Absolutely. And I think that it also underscores just that what we practice now is not what was practiced in the Buddhist time. And and I have this tendency to, wish that I, or try to figure out what exactly Dogen wants me to do. and I've heard major debates, are you supposed to walk in Kinhin like this or like this? Fist up or sideways. And in the end, who really cares? We're never going to recapture that. It's gone. It's dead. And sometimes we worship dead things. Or we try and lock them in. And I think this can be a very constructive, if painful, process. It would be so much easier if we could just do it exactly like the Japanese do, don't you think? We would know what to do anyway. Well, it wouldn't work.
Having studied and practiced in Japan, no, I don't want to do that. But also, I don't want to do, what we're doing. We have to continue evolving. And, but also, your example of the Heart Sutra, and throughout Buddhist history, there have been revolutions. And even in Asian, modern Asian Buddhism is also responding to modernity and changing, partly in response to the West. And so I think the point of our practice is to make it fresh and to make it work for us here in Chicago in a storefront temple. So, of course, it has to be changing all the time. And so, your topic is right to the point. As a scholar and a successor of Dogen's lineage and a scholar of Dogen, I love Dogen, but I don't agree with everything he said. If I agreed with everything he said, I wouldn't be loyal to Dogen. So, anyway, other comments about other aspects of what Roy brought up, Nyozan?
Well, just responding to a couple of things. I mean, it's sort of implied in what Roy said. I mean, in response to your question, Bill, there was a major shift in orientation between the early Vinyana, so called, and the Mahayana, which was a major reorientation. And then in a few weeks, for example, Paul Kopp will be talking about the image of Kanado, which we chanted, which again sort of flips things away from the impermanent, painful, suffering and egoless. And he'll talk about that. But what I want to mention, because I think it's important here, or relevant here, is there's a line in Dogen in Genjo Koan. Here it's translated, it has not existed before this moment, nor has it come into existence now. I think I've heard it also, it's not directly given from the past, nor does it arise in this moment. And I think that's important because it implies that there's a relationship, a dependent co-arising, if you will, sort of temporally, between these sort of different sort of phases that we go through in our thinking. And none of this contradicts what you were saying. I mean, that in itself is sort of like a very, very strong statement of emptiness and our own inability to articulate that in any sort of stable, permanent terms. Because we're just left with that.
Thank you. Yeah.
Real quickly, one thing that I was going to mention is interdependent co-arising, to me, interdependent co-arising that says that okay, we don't have this atomistic items, and really throws out our typical way of thinking of cause and effect that A causes B causes C. That doesn't work. And I really think we need to come up as a community with a new theory of causation that's much more grounded in interdependent co-arising. Although I started to look at some of the theory that's out there on cause and effect, and it's way over my head. So it would take me years to try to just understand what's out there now. But I do think that introverted arising is basically just an expression of emptiness.
Yeah.
That there aren't solitary items out there, and that all of reality is one whole, and that what we see as cause and effect is much more just the flow of that whole, you know, like one pearl, as it's called.
In terms of cause and effect, you mentioned Joanna Macy a couple of times, and one of the things that she talks about a lot that I think is very important to all of this is future generations, and actually befriending future generations and realizing that part of what affects and causes what's happening right now is the influence of future generations, and to see future generations and specific beings in the future as relevant to us. And that's a very different paradigm, but I think very, very helpful to our practice, that we're not just practicing, you know, just, well, not for our personal selves, but, and not even for just everybody else in this room, but actually that we're practicing for, you know, as I say, sometimes, you know, the people walking down Irving Park Road 50 years from now and 250 years from now, and they're practicing for us too. So that's one shift. But before we, and it's almost time to stop, but I really appreciated the things that you brought forth, what you said about gender and sexuality, and I just wanted to invite any comments or responses on that. I mean, that's a huge topic, but it's so important. So I really appreciated what you said about that. If anyone has any responses, I wanted to just invite that. Okay.
I didn't hear all of it because I had to walk out to be part of it on those comments. But I actually agree with what you had to say. This is a big paradigm shift. Yeah.
And I think we think of these shifts as being in some sort of, you know, scientific theory, but they work in real life too.
Well, it's very visceral. You know, who we are sexually is a huge part of how we think of ourselves, and to see the flexibility of that is very important.
I had one thought about that. I don't know, you know, about her conversing with queer theory or whatever, but one aspect of that, as you articulated, that would not be a paradigm shift, is it seemed to continue this sort of aspect of being rooted in this sort of self-contained individual, self-determining, non-fungible. And again, I mean, in terms of thinking about how people choose to lead their lives, that makes perfect sense. But what is not articulated there is, again, this idea of dependent co-arising, that in fact, there are no entirely self-contained individuals, and that who we are is in large part, you know, not rooted in some, you know, bowling ball type of weight, but in a whole system of relations that are beyond our comprehension, and certainly beyond our control. Mm-hmm.
And context. I was raised in I grew up in the 50s, and for people who grew up in the 80s or the 90s, you know, that's a whole different context of how we see sexuality.
And I, you know, one thing I'd like to emphasize is that, again, this is not to say that the queer paradigm is better than the old one. I think even for married couples, that we need to have flexibility. We need to realize that the view of marriage, that it's, you know, one man and one woman, or one man and one man, or whatever it is, that that's what makes a marriage, is ridiculous. You're in a context of a community. Each of you work, you have kids, you have family members, you have, you know, parents. All of these influence who we are and how we live our lives. So to just put a box around, you know, this relationship and say that's normal or that's marriage is just looking at the wrong frame, I think, in many ways. And I think no matter, the most traditional marriage in the world can gain from thinking about things in a much more flexible way.
Okay.
I think the queer paradigm is much better because it explodes the essentialistic idea that there's just some normal, quote unquote, that's easily read off from some supposed reality. But what I wanted to say is that it does also make the precept about, however one wants to word that, but basically about taking up the way of approaching sexuality in a responsible and respectful manner. It's very complicated in the moment in which you live.
Yes.
I think.
It is.
It's difficult.